Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
All is quiet at the New York State Capitol this week now that lawmakers have left for the spring holidays, despite not yet completing a state budget that was due April 1st. As the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports, differences over whether to once again change New York's bail reform laws continue to simmer.
Governor Kathy Hochul held up the budget for 9 days last year to successfully win changes to the state's 2019 bail reform laws. The laws, which ended many forms of cash bail, have been controversial. Supporters say it prevents lengthy stays in jail for people who are accused of minor crimes but can't afford to post bail. But opponents say the laws have been a factor in the crime spike that began during the pandemic. They say they should be fully repealed. Hochul has tried to walk a middle line, saying the law does improve things for those accused of misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies. But she says the laws need to be further revised to give judges more discretion to set bail when someone is charged with more serious crimes. Hochul, in an interview with public radio in late March, said she wants to get rid of the requirement that judges must use the least restrictive means when deciding whether to set bail for someone accused of a felony.
I am working hard to have policies that make sense, to give clarity to judges so there's no inconsistency, that we deal with the serious offenses. And this is what New Yorkers want us to do.
Hochul has public opinion polls on her side, along with the aid of a political action committee partly funded by billionaire businessman Michael Bloomberg, which is running ads supporting the governor's proposals.
9 out of 10 New Yorkers agree crime is a serious problem. People want the bail laws fixed and action on public safety.
Democrats who lead both houses of the legislature have not been swayed. Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie says he and his members are reluctant to once again change the bail reform laws because they don't believe that the data shows that bail reform has contributed to the crime spike. He points to a John Jay College study that found the law was working and reduced recidivism rates for those accused of misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies. And Hastie says while other states have given judges more power to determine whether an accused person presents a danger to themselves or others, they have not seen a corresponding reduction in crime.
Our next door neighbor in New Jersey, their index crimes are up. They have a dangerousness standard. So that's what I'm saying. Like, this is the difficulty that you have in trying to deal with a perception problem when the data is up all across the nation, even in states, like I said, that have a dangerousness standard. They have pretrial detention. None of those things have been able to solve the issue of crime going down.
The speaker acknowledges, though, that a public perception that things are less safe is real and needs to be addressed. But he says bail reform has been made the scapegoat. Senate Republican Minority Leader Robert Ort backs Hochul's proposal, but wishes it went further. He says instead of arguing about the root causes for the crime spike, Democratic lawmakers should ask themselves if the current bail laws are making things safer.
Are these laws making New Yorkers more safe? Are we helping with the spike in crime? Is it contributing to it? Or is it just adding to the chaos, another log on the fire?
Ort, who has held office for 8 years, says he's never seen the budget process lag this far behind. And he says many key issues, including how much the total spending should be and how to pay for it, have yet to be addressed.
The first time I can ever remember getting to this date with really just absolutely no clarity on a state budget, even a framework.
Also unresolved is the question of whether to raise taxes to finance the spending. Ort and Hochul oppose raising taxes on the rich. Democrats in the Senate and Assembly back an increase. Ort says this year's budget process harkens back to earlier decades when state budgets were often weeks or even months late. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
People and organizations tied to state government are on hold because the New York State budget is late, Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
For the second year in a row, the New York State budget is late. Good government groups are pinning the blame on Governor Kathy Hochul. New York Public Interest Research Group Executive Director Blair Horner, a WAMC commentator, says any time that the government doesn't do what it's supposed to do, it feeds public cynicism about Albany.
They were supposed to get the budget done last week, and that didn't happen. The governor's advanced an extender through a week from today, which should alleviate at least some of the initial concerns that people might have. If the government does not approve an extender, bills can't be paid, employees can't be paid. Essentially, the government shuts down. And so that's not good for anybody. And there doesn't seem to be any indication that lawmakers will reject the governor's week-long extender. You know, when you're rolling the dice like this, when people are playing with fire, sometimes the public gets burned.
John Caney is the executive director of the watchdog group Reinvent Albany.
In our view, a late budget happens when the legislature asserts itself as a co-equal branch of government and says no to the governor inserting big policy issues into the budget rather than taking them on during the legislative session. And in this case, those two big policy issues, however you feel about them, are bail and the land use housing plan that the governor's put forth. And whatever the merits of those proposals, they are not budget items. They are, in fact, major policy decisions.
Horner agrees.
The governor's insisting that bail reforms be included as part of a budget agreement package. And while there is no real indication that the issue of bail reform has anything to do with the budget, the governor has her greatest leverage in budget negotiations, and so that's what she's doing. So she's linked together bail reform issues, as she sees it, with approval of a final budget agreement. And in Albany, nothing gets done until everything gets done.
Assemblymember Pat Fahey of the 109th District says in her 11 years of service, she hasn't seen the budget go this late.
You have different constituencies opposing parts of the housing compact than what you have of those who are trying to find I call them small but very significant changes that are needed to address some of the public safety concerns. And we have members who represent different areas of the state, and in some areas those are tougher issues than in other. Long Island, for example, is a region that opposes the housing compact. Up here, I think there is more of a recognition that we truly need to grow our housing stock and protect tenants and address the predatory practices of some landlords.
Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan, a fellow Democrat, says she doesn't expect the budget delay to affect the city.
There are some really important issues that are being debated and that are important to the governor and that need to be addressed before the budget moves forward. So at this point, it's not impacting us, and we hope that it gets resolved. But it needs to be resolved in a way that is good for all New Yorkers.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok spoke with Blair Horner, executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG, this week, about the budget and what a late budget means for New Yorkers.
Well, you know, of course, it depends on how late is late. But, in recent years, the budget has blown past the April 1st deadline, and the budget usually gets wrapped up in the first half of April. And so if you do that right, it's no harm, no foul in terms of the delivery of services to the state. That being said, of course, their job is to get the budget done by April 1st. And when they don't, it just sort of feeds into the increasing cynicism of New Yorkers that their state government doesn't get things done like they're supposed to. But as a practical matter, vendors getting paid, public employees getting paid, services being delivered, the lights being on in state government. If the budget's late by a couple of weeks, it doesn't have any sort of dramatic impact. Now, we've seen in the olden days, when the budgets were late by months, that it does create problems for vendors and for delivery of services. But in recent years, probably over the past 15, that hasn't happened.
Wow. So anyway, there are big budget items you have written that are festering while the debate plays out. For example, how will state leaders pull together enough money to plug the MTA's expected budget gap of nearly $3 billion? Lawmakers have so far rejected the governor's plan to raise the transit costs for suburban areas, and the New York City mayor is opposing the governor's proposal to take $500 million, it's not chump change, out of the city's budget to support the MTA. What do you make of that?
Well, this sort of goes back to the previous question. And one of the reasons why the budgets are late is because the governor insists on something being added to the budget, often something that has really very little to do, if anything, to do with the budget at all. So this year, I was at a press conference that the speaker had, and when asked about what's being discussed at the budget tables, he said, bail, bail, bail. And what he was talking about is the governor's proposals to reform the New York system of how judges have discretion in terms of figuring out what the bail should be for an alleged perpetrator. And that is not really a budget item. I mean, of course, in the sense that everything's part of the budget, you can make the argument, sure. But it's not really central to the budget. And because of that, issues like what you just mentioned on the MTA and where's the money going to come from, all of those issues sort of can chug along to getting 90% done, but then they're frozen until the big ticket item gets done because that's when the horse training starts. We don't really know what's going to happen necessarily on the funding of the MTA, but one of the major financial, could be a very serious financial problem for the state is what happens to the MTA because of the pandemic, because of poor budgeting over the years, and the fact that you can't really function, the city of New York cannot function without a good mass transit system. The state's going to have to come up with some dough to make that happen. And how they're going to do it, I think, is anyone's guess. Generally speaking, Albany likes to kick the can on the MTA, but because of the pandemic and the weakening finances, I don't think they can keep kicking the can after this year.
Well, if they keep kicking the can, sooner or later the can is going to hit Charlie right in the behind.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And you're exactly right. And it plays out across the board. I mean, you look at the public colleges all across the state. They're losing enrollment. The state has been, you know, shifting the costs onto family members. The governor's proposing to keep doing that. And what's the state's policy to reverse that trend? Well, you can't tell until the budget sort of comes together, and that's frozen because of the debate over what should be done over bail reform.
Now, let me ask you this. What about the fact that the budget is negotiated mostly in secret, two women and a man in the room?
And, of course, any negotiation where you have a lot of people involved and a lot of high stakes, at some point people have to discuss sort of off the record how they're going to handle it. And so in every negotiation, a portion of it is done in secret, no matter what it is. But in Albany land, the budget can also get derailed because of insistence on topics that no one had thought about in advance or had proposed. So last year, for example, out of nowhere, the governor decided to jam through a big subsidy for the Buffalo Bills' new football stadium. And this year, she decided to try to jam through at the last minute with no preparation, as far as I could tell, a plan to weaken the state's climate law because of concerns over affordability. That program had been in the works for years. And nobody raised any, well, not nobody, but the governor's office said there were no problems until like a week ago. And so when you're in secret, bad things can happen, even if I think everyone would recognize that portions of sort of figuring out how you're going to come to an agreement between three different views on the budget, the Assembly, the Senate, and the governor, has to be to some extent discussed in private. The problem is because of the over-reliance on secrecy, bad things can happen in the budget that cost New Yorkers an arm and a leg. And that's the part that's the biggest problem.
Well, yes, it's the biggest problem, but the New Yorkers even know that it's there, that it's a problem.
Well, they'll notice if the governor's proposals advance on climate change. They'll notice it because the state will have more pollution And if they don't handle her concerns over costs properly, they'll notice it when they go to pay for gasoline or turn on their electricity in their house and see their bill. So, yeah, I mean, they'll see it, but unfortunately, it's way after the fact. And so that's why the secrecy in Albany has always worked in the sense of horse trading, is because people don't feel the impacts until after the fact. And then, you know, after the fact, it's hard to change it.
That's Blair Horner, executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, speaking with Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartong. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A potential animal tranquilizer called xylazine is showing up in illicit opioid markets all over the Northeast. The drug causes painful withdrawal symptoms, severe wounds, and a knockout high that puts people using it at serious risk. It's also not an opioid, so it doesn't respond to the overdose-reversing drug Narcan. Reporting for the Legislative Gazette, WSKG's Phoebe Taylor-Wolo reports that while public health officials are grappling with how to respond to xylazine, harm reduction providers say it's just the latest in a rapidly evolving drug market.
The Southern Tier AIDS Program keeps a bad batch board hanging on the wall at their syringe exchange in Johnson City. People coming by the location to get clean syringes can write on the board if they've had a bad or unusual experience with a drug. The whiteboard is covered with simple descriptions, like yellow dope equals ketamine, purple dope causing immediate ODs, turquoise equals not dope. Be careful.
I think people are concerned. Again, it's why they're coming in and sharing with us. You know, the stuff was this color and this consistency, and it had this effect.
That's John Barry, the executive director of the Southern Tier AIDS Program, or STAP. He says they've heard reports of some of the symptoms of xylazine, a veterinary anesthetic showing up in the drug supply all over the region. Xylazine can cause open sores and painful, sometimes black wounds on the skin. The wounds can show up anywhere on the body, not just at injection sites. It's a deep sedative, and it can knock people out for hours. But Barry says xylazine is just the latest in a string of synthetic drugs added to opioids to make them smaller, stronger, and easier to smuggle. He calls that the iron law of prohibition. The harder law enforcement cracks down on a drug, the more dangerous it gets.
When alcohol was illegal in this country, people were shipping whiskey from Canada, you know, not cases of beer. So the more law enforcement you bring into the equation, the more dangerous, the more concentrated, and the more poisonous you were going to make the drugs, period, full stop.
People don't know they're using xylazine because it's cut into opioids like fentanyl and a lot of other random drugs to bulk up the supply. Jessica Irvine, STAP's harm reduction coordinator, says the bad batch board is a useful community resource, but it's not enough.
Often people will come in and like read this, but they'll say, well, what is it then? Like, turquoise, dope, don't use it, be careful, but why?
STAP will soon be able to test drugs using a spectrometer. With a tiny sample, the machine can tell you every substance a drug has been cut with. STAP has two machines now, and some of the staff are learning how to test people's drugs in real time. Fernando Montero is a medical anthropologist at Columbia University. He's studied the effects of synthetic drugs like xylazine and fentanyl on the drug market in Philadelphia. Xylazine was found in 91% of opioid samples tested in Philadelphia in 2021.
It's not heroin anymore. Like, for the most part, people in the Northeast are now consuming fentanyl, a little bit of fentanyl and a lot of xylazine.
For years, he says, if you were buying street opioids, you usually got heroin. When fentanyl showed up, it replaced heroin, and that's caused ripple effects.
From the point of view of a person who uses drugs, who uses opioids every day, fentanyl is a worse drug in many respects than heroin. And the most important way in which it is worse is that it lasts so much less.
That means people get sick much faster and have to use more often to stave off withdrawal. Montero says that's opened the door to other synthetics like xylazine. When combined with fentanyl, xylazine extends its effects.
It replicates heroin a little bit. You know, it mimics heroin. And that's what makes it appealing to consumers. Then again, it also introduces all these new problems, right?
Back in the parking lot of the Southern Tier AIDS program in Johnson City, Dean O'Gorman and Kurt Kleefeld run a mobile harm reduction van. They hand out syringes and connect people to resources, and they drive across 11 counties to reach people. O'Gorman says they've seen the spread of new synthetics in the supply.
Being mobile in different areas, we could see where it would start in Broome or Syracuse and merge into the Cortland and spread out to Norwich or, you know, Elmira areas, and you could see the color change, basically, of what's going on with the drug.
Kleefeld says it's hard to keep up with the changing drug supply.
Our company, Canadian company, just came out with a xylazine test strip. Great, that's awesome. And in the back of my mind, I think, whoa, six months from now, what's going to be the new thing that's out that we don't have the technology to help people with, you know?
In the meantime, though, the STAP team still has tools that work. O'Gorman is adamant that people should still use Narcan. And no matter how the drug supply changes, people will still need clean syringes and connections to healthcare and housing. In Vestal, I'm Phoebe Taylor-Fuolo.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government, politics. I'm David Gustina. The first recreational cannabis sale in the Capital Region was made late last week. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard was in Schenectady for a soft opening of the region's first dispensary.
With the cut of the green ribbon, Upstate Canico on Upper Union Street began its first day of retail cannabis sales, the first dispensary to open in the Capital Region. Following a ceremony for the news cameras, store manager Renata Filiacci pointed to a large glass display case filled with a variety of products.
We have our flower up here, and then we have gummies, edibles, vapes, drinks. Pre-rolls, we'll have more tinctures, and then we'll have CBD, a whole CBD section.
With a grand opening set for Saturday morning, Filiacci says the store is ready to serve the public.
We've received probably 99% of our stuff so far. So, but we probably will have more, and we'll see what happens.
Friends and supporters crowded the retail counter as Upstate Canico made its first sale. The first buyer was Chuck Vandermark, head grower at Adirondack Hemp, one of the dispensary's cultivators. Vandermark, who picked up two strains of cannabis flower, said he couldn't believe that he was making the first purchase of legal cannabis, let alone his own product.
It's changing my whole life. I mean, I went from being a criminal for the past 30 years to now being accepted in the community and able to tell people what I do for a living. I've never been able to talk about this my whole life. This is something that we weren't able to do. So this is a big moment.
Upstate Canico is operating under one of New York's conditional adult-use retail dispensary licenses, the first kind of license rolled out in the state. The card program is intended to help operators who have been most impacted by cannabis prohibition. Don Andrews is the owner of Upstate Canico.
It's been a long journey. I've been through a bunch of BS to get to where I'm at today. So it just feels good to be in the position that I'm in and to be able to work with like-minded people and to be able to give back to my community too at the same time. So it's a great feeling.
Applicants are also required to demonstrate they've operated a profitable business. Prior to changing its name to Upstate Canico, the retail store in Schenectady was named Upstate CBD. Prior to that, Andrews opened a vape shop in the neighboring village of Scotia a decade ago. Even before New York legalized recreational cannabis 2 years ago, Andrews said he was preparing for this moment.
As our neighboring states opted in, it was only a matter of time before New York did. So I just kind of set that up for myself so we can kind of just jump right in when the market became legal in New York.
Andrews' license allows him to sell adult-use cannabis at 3 locations. He's planning on bringing cannabis to upstate Canico's nearby Glenville location next. Glenville opted out of state law allowing retail dispensaries and on-site consumption sites in 2021. Glenville Town Supervisor Chris Ketzley, a Republican who showed up to support Andrews on Friday, said the town will be considering a change.
The town board is looking at it and is talking with Don about it and our planners, and it looks like we'll be calling a public hearing this Wednesday for the 19th. On the matter before the town board makes a determination one way or the other to allow it or not to allow it.
The launch of recreational cannabis has advanced at a snail's pace in New York, with upstate Canico joining just a handful of locations opened since late December. Chris Alexander, executive director of the New York State Office of Cannabis Management, acknowledged the slow rollout.
But it's part of the nature of what we've committed ourselves to doing, right? We committed ourselves to doing this in a little bit of a different kind of way. And so, you know, we just got to keep going. We're going to see kind of an uptick in openings in the next couple of weeks and months. I know it's been slow, you know, getting to this point, but honestly, we're trying to grow the market responsibly. We've got, you know, some really great product coming down the supply chain. And, you know, we're just going every day trying to get more and more stores open.
Reporting from Schenectady, I'm Lucas Willard.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2314. Or just listen online at WAMC.org or schedule a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gostino.